Hello, and welcome to the Permaculture Project. This day, March 10th, 2012. Taking care of Earth, taking care of people, and sharing surplus. I'm your host, James Cosley. This is a call-in show. You're welcome to call in. Any questions concerning permaculture? And the call-in numbers are 888-627-6008. There's other lines. Line 1 would be 530-327-7602 or 530-413-4522 and 530-413-5011. Join in on the discussion with questions or comments. Last week, we had a great show. Our guests were Nicholas Katcher of New Economics Institute, Anthony Cheravallo of Social Entrepreneurs, and Bill Summers of the Permaculture Credit Union. That was a really good show. We talked a lot about economics, on the future of job searching, social consciousness, and other things that relate to permaculture, which means a permanent culture, more than just gardening. It's a whole lifestyle, if you want to call it that. Today, our show is dedicated to permaculture design. Now we're going to get into the intricacies of permaculture and gardening. And our special guest today is Corinne Irby, of Breaking Ground. Corinne? Of Breaking Hello. Ground Permaculture in Bozeman, Montana.
Hi there.
Corinne, are you there?
Hi. Yes, I am. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, good. I'm excited. And Corinne, let's start with a little bit of history about Broken Ground and yourself. You want to fill us in on some details?
Sure. Well, I just founded Broken Ground actually last summer upon my return after doing an advanced permaculture training with Jeff Lawton at the Permaculture Research Institute in Australia. And as some of your listeners might know, Australia is kind of where permaculture started, its origins, when it was kind of the term was coined by Bill Mollison and David Holmgren. So my teacher, Jeff Lawton, was a mentee of Bill Mollison, and I did an advanced permaculture program there. But my interest in permaculture started much earlier. I'd say that just as a young girl, I was always interested in the environment and deeply concerned about the environment. I actually did a degree in environmental science, an undergraduate degree, and then I took off in another direction and focused on social justice and human rights issues for quite a few years in the nonprofit field. And but I was finding that it was really difficult to always be against something. You know, oftentimes in the social justice field, you're against some policy or something that's going on or something that is happening in the world. And I kind of got burned out, and I decided that rather than being against something, I wanted to create something and be part of something. And I think a lot of people go towards growing their own food and being more sustainable. So I went and I took actually a class with, I was interested in globalization and the impact of globalization on not only the environment, but on people. And I went and took a class with Vandana Shiva, who's a very well-known advocate for seed saving. And I went and took a class with her, and she talked about the links between Gandhi and his movement and globalization and our need to go more local and to produce more local. And from there, that introduced me to the whole world of permaculture. I took my permaculture design certificate in 2006, and ever since then have been trying to practice permaculture and in every way, shape, or form that I can.
Well, that's really interesting because it leads into something that I've been wanting to ask all of my guests, and especially anyone connected with permaculture. And you kind of answered it, I think. But, you know, I've always been curious, you know, was this a choice of lifestyle activism, or did you feel it a necessity to to turn the permaculture?
Oh, that's a really loaded question. I think it's a lifestyle choice for me. It's a choice of values, and what I feel like is not necessarily, I don't want to say a better way of living, but a more sustainable way of living, where you don't have to necessarily be destructive and destroy this beautiful planet that we've been given, and that you can live in abundance and you can live with all that you need using, you know, permaculture design as a tool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm kind of curious too. I mean, do you know, sometimes people get into a, if you want to call it a movement or a way of thinking in mm-hmm. permaculture, and it almost becomes a like a discipline, much like a religious or spiritual commitment. And, this method is the only way, as opposed to, well, let's just say, for instance, making dirt, making soil, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's something I've been looking at and researching about biochar, and some people say, well, no, don't want to do that if you're doing permaculture, because where does that smoke go? It burns into the carbon, you know, burns up into the atmosphere. So I'm curious, do you have that type of a discipline with the permaculture, or are you willing to look at other ways that have already been set forth?
I definitely am willing to look at other ways. I think too much time in the activist field really made me sense that, or operate under the assumption that we don't want to go to extremes, or we don't want to say absolutes. I think that there's room for all sorts of different disciplines within, both within permaculture and in addition to permaculture. Permaculture is just one way of thinking about design, of designing a sustainable human habitat, but I don't think people should be limited by that, just like anything, right? I don't think that a narrow point of view is usually not the best way to go about any kind of field. It's considering other options as well. With the understanding, of course, that the world is a complex place, and if you live from the values of earth care, people care, and fair share, or if you live from the value of wanting to leave this planet for future generations, then you will make choices accordingly. But I'm not as strict as many people in the permaculture field are in terms of identifying what is permaculture and what isn't permaculture. It's a label, like so many other things, and so you don't want to be restricted so much by the label, and yet it's a useful label in certain contexts for people to understand the science behind it.
That's great. Well, now that we've touched a little bit, earth care, people care, fair share, you want to touch on, elaborate a little bit on those terms for us? What is meant earth care in terms of permaculture ethics?
Sure. Well, earth care is what you would expect. It's taking care of the earth, taking care of the rivers, the soils, the streams, the air, the trees, the forest. So that's kind of, you know, taking care of the earth. People care is maybe a little bit more complex insofar as that it's about, if it's something that enslaves people, if it's something that's destructive towards people, well, then that's not permaculture, right? That you start with your family. Well, first of all, you start with yourself and taking care of yourself, and then you extend out to your family and out to your community. And part of that people care, too, is creating those networks in order to be able to live sustainably. And I think a lot of the, and that's usually what's called oftentimes in permaculture is the social permaculture aspect of things, and I think your show last week kind of encompassed that. You know, what can we do? Can we set up credit unions? Can we figure out new and innovative economic models that can be used where we have to network with people, we have to be part of a community, we have to work together in order to make this happen, you know. And then, and lastly, I guess, fair share is this whole idea that if I have extra resources, I feed them back to the first two ethics. So if I have extra time on my hands, maybe I lend a hand to my neighbor in his or her garden. If I have extra manure, I give that to the community garden. If I have knowledge to share, I very much feel like what I'm doing with Broken Ground and the workshops that we're giving in the Gallatin Valley community, that's knowledge that I can share with other people. So it's basically, if you have extra resources, they're fed back into the earth to make the earth more fertile, to make the soil more fertile, or they're fed back to the people, giving them knowledge. Or if you have extra veggies from your garden, you're either selling them or giving them to people in the community. But in inherent in that fair share principle is this idea that in order for us to have things to share, we also have to have a limit on the consumption and growth that we have. That can't be infinite consumption and growth. It certainly has to be limited in some way in order for us all to have a piece of the pie, so to speak.
That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Well, let's get a little bit into how you approach some permaculture design. In other words, if you go to a client, what are some of the principles that you would be looking at?
Right. Well, of course, the first one that I'm sure you use as well is the idea of observing and interacting. So that's one of the first permaculture principles. And the principles are basically guidelines, right? And so on a site, if I come onto a site with a client, the first thing I'm observing are things like, where does the water flow? Where does the wind come from? Perhaps where do the leaves accumulate in the yard, depending on the season? Where does the sun hit? Where are the shady spots? Is there a soggy part of the property where the snow stays and lingers? Is there a more dry area of the property? And these are things that I think that people unconsciously, maybe they recognize or they know in the back of their heads, but I think in permaculture design, the idea is to kind of turn up and tune into those senses a little bit more, to really stop and listen and look and see what's happening. Because what you want to do is, of course, look at patterns that are happening on a property, patterns, natural patterns that are happening. And the whole idea in design work, of course, is to harmonize with those patterns. So those are some of the first things that I want to know, because, of course, if you're trying to work towards sustainable human habitat, you're trying to grow things. You know, one of the things that you're trying to do is grow things. So in order to grow things, you need sun, and you need water, and you need soil, and you need fertility. So seeing what types of resources that you have existing on the site, because as much as possible, you want to, you know, not have to bring in so many resources from outside of a property or outside of your property or any client's property. So I'd say that's kind of the first approach that I take. And then you kind of move into opportunities to catch and store that energy. Again, does the client already have solar panels? If so, that's great. Does the client have a greenhouse? If not, is there an opportunity to put in a greenhouse? Would there be an area, a south-facing area that would be appropriate? How can you catch and store as much energy as possible on that site? So how can you catch the wind energy that comes onto that site? How can you catch the sun energy that comes onto that site? How can you catch the water? Doesn't mean you're able to put in rainwater catchment in some way in the form of a of an actual barrel or in the form of what's called a swale in permaculture, which is a ditch on contour. So those are all things, first and foremost, that you want to look at. And I will say that, you know, in the design science of permaculture, the recommendation is you have these observations, but you take them without any judgment. You know, you don't immediately say, oh, the snow doesn't melt there, so that's not a good place for a garden. You know, you just take down these observations initially, and then, you know, you can, when you've gotten further along in your design, you can maybe mix and match what you've observed with where you want to put what are called elements in your system. And elements in your system are things like your garden, a pond, a greenhouse. Those are all what are considered elements in your system. So that's that's where I begin. And then, of course, then there's the whole briefing with the client in terms of what they want. You know, it's all fine and good if you observe all of this stuff, but you also want to know what the client's needs and desires are for his or her property. So that's where I go. I'm not sure if you want me to go into a little bit more detail, but...
Well, yeah, you know, one big question of mine is, or concern would be water.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you're in Bozeman, Montana. I actually live in a similar area close to you.
Right.
And a lot of our water comes from wells. And if you live mm-hmm. in town, of course, you have city water. But if you have a well, for instance, you know, to put in a full irrigation system as opposed to a water catchment system where, you know, you do different things to retain water in an area as long as you can so you can use less of the supply. Do you look at that as what type of opportunities might occur there or what you would do to hold water in an area and slowly let it leak into a garden site? Or...
Right, absolutely. And I think that that's actually here in Montana, I think that's a major concern, that if you don't have water, you can't grow much, and that's a limiting factor. And so I think that any ability to collect water, if you're on a larger property and any ability to collect water upslope from, you know, on your property is great. But rainwater catchment in permaculture figures very large. And one of the whole ideas behind that is the whole, you want to slow the water down, you want to spread the water, and you want to sink the water, and potentially store the water. So the four S's. And people, if they have properties, should keep that in mind. How can I slow, spread, sink, and store as much water as possible on my site? So is that through a ditch on contour? Is that through rainwater barrels? Is that through, if I don't have a slope, is that through rain gardens, or what are called also infiltration basins, which are basically kind of, you create these low points on your property so that water can collect in those areas. So that's definitely... When you're looking at a permaculture design, you usually, or a property, I should say, usually go from water, from considering where the water is coming from and how to design water into your system, to access, how you're going to access your site, to then you design in your structures. So if you have the ability, or if you have a piece of land where you haven't yet built anything, that's actually advantageous in a way, because you can first design in where are you going to put those swales in order to collect water? And then you can design, after you've done that, then you can design over that where you're going to put your roads. And then after that, that kind of determines oftentimes where your structures might be. But at every point in time, a roof of a structure is such a great place to collect water. And we don't take advantage necessarily of that enough here in Montana, especially when water is scarce. So any ability to have your eye towards capturing that resource, and the idea being keeping that water on your land for as long as possible before it exits your property, is the goal in a permaculture design.
That makes a lot of sense. And speaking of that, what about gray water systems? How can
right.
you put together a gray water system and, let's say, existing plumbing, for instance? What kind of effort might be involved in that? And do you find that clients are willing to do it?
That gets a little trickier. And I think here there's always a little bit of a question about, you know, what happens in the winter, cold, all of that kind of stuff. It's a fairly simple process. I'll admit I don't have a lot of experience with it, and perhaps you do with some of your clients. But it's a very easy, it could be as easy as if you don't want to put a pipe out into your garden, that would be the place where the gray water goes. It's even having a bowl under your sink, right? It could be as simple as that. Now, that gets a little bit tedious in terms of having to empty that bowl out. But gray water, recycling gray water within your house and your system is another way to keep that water on your site as much as possible. Because, of course, that water is very beneficial, provided, of course, you have to be careful about what you're using, and what kind of soaps you're using, and a little bit more conscious of what you're throwing down the sink. But it can be very beneficial for plants, and of course you can have those plants do the filtration for you rather than having that gray water contribute to the city sewage system, for example. So I think
might that be like a little wetland or something?
Exactly. So then it would get, again, allowing the plants to do the cleaning for you. So setting up a small wetland area that absorbs that gray water from your house is a great option for people. But there's still, I think, same with something like composting toilets, of course. There's a little bit of education that needs to be done around those types of more involved, I would say, aspects of design obviously in town you can't have a composting toilet, and yet if you want to conserve water, that's going to be one of the best ways to do it, right? To have a compost toilet where you're not using water to flush. You're just setting up a system where you have wood chips and your urine and feces that go into that whole system. Now, that's not something that's realistic, like I said, in town, but in terms of water conservation, that would be a huge contribution to conserving water by doing that.
Or it might be as simple as keeping the water in your bathtub and getting some 5-gallon buckets and hauling that to water plants in your greenhouse or even outdoors or whatever.
Right, of course. And I think that's the thing about it, too. I think for people that know about permaculture, sometimes it can be pretty overwhelming. It's like, oh, it's all about, you know, setting up this homestead, and that's going to require time, that's going to require money. But the great thing about permaculture is that a lot of it is common sense. And so it's little steps that you can take in your home to conserve. It's little steps that you already probably take. You know, if you dry your clothes after washing them and you dry them on a rack, you know, I'll put them near the heater, right, so that the heater is not only warming the room, but it's helping to dry the clothes. Those are permaculture principles. The wood stove is not only to heat the house, but if you put a pot of water on top of the stove, then it's going to boil the water. If you hang a line above the stove, then you're going to be able to dry your dish towels. So all of those elements are little permaculture actions, so to speak. But there are a lot of common sense things that people already do in their home.
And for people that don't or are brand new into it, it could be a real conscious awareness or effort to take those steps and do that. You know, one thing, I sometimes it could be real overwhelming, especially if you've already developed some gardening around your house or whatever, and all of a sudden you have to backtrack and say, oh my gosh, this isn't working. And I know somewhere in your website I read about starting small, so you don't have to go back and redo things. And so when you approach a client and you're looking at a site like that, or is that something that you discuss with a client and put them at ease a little bit?
I think, yes, absolutely. And I think that that's something that in my workshops also that I reinforce is this whole idea that you want small successes. You don't want to go out there and design, you know, a property with all of your zones and, you know, you're planting up a timber forest over here, and you have your vegetable garden over here, and then you're going to get chickens and goats and ducks, and you're going to add them all into your system. That obviously is not a recipe necessarily for disaster, but it's a recipe for burnout for sure. So trying to do a little bit and seeing how that works, what that does as well is it brings back that whole principle of observing, so that you start small with a small vegetable garden or an herb garden or a salad garden, and you see how that works on your property. It allows you time to observe how good your soil is, what types of challenges you have, what type of worker you are, what you like and what you don't like, what's convenient for you, what's inconvenient for you. Maybe you thought that the compost pile was a good place for it right there, but it turns out that that's too far away, or it turns out that you don't really use it there, or maybe the vegetable garden, you didn't notice that there was a big shady spot when you were doing your site analysis, and turns out you can't grow in that area. So trying to do a small plot which fits with your lifestyle and your time commitment and your willingness to do it is good. And then you look at it, you observe it, you change it the next year, you expand the next year based on your experience. It's better than trying to put in, you know, all sorts of systems in one season, because then otherwise you'll probably be troubleshooting all of those different systems. Rather than in permaculture, what's recommended, what I recommend to clients too, is a phased design, right? That you can, I could design for you a whole property from zone 1 to 5, but you may not put all of that in the first year. You may take, you know, several seasons to put all of that in. And the recommendation is, of course, you start close in. You start with your zone 1. You start with what's closest to your house, because of course that's what you're going to see more often, and that's what you're therefore going to maintain more often. So really, you know, in permaculture, there's a whole thing about scale, and that applies on several different layers. But the reason that we're maybe in the environmental crisis that we're in, or we have soil degradation, or air pollution, is that everything is out of scale, right? Our cities are out of scale, our economies are out of scale, our agriculture is out of scale. So the idea is to bring things back into scale, so when things are out of scale, what wastes that could be resources become pollution. For example, a factory farm, right? That manure that's produced by those cows, by those pigs, is actually an incredibly rich resource that could be fed back into the system and used to boost fertility. But because it's a factory farm and so much volume is produced and it's out of scale, you can't use that resource quickly enough to make it a resource for you, and then it becomes a waste product. So if you scale back in a permaculture system and you take that and look at it and you have a few cows rather than, you know, several hundred, those cows and that waste, that manure that they contribute is excellent for your garden. And so therefore you can cycle things much more easily in a smaller scale system.
Yes, it's interesting that you brought that up about scale, and I'm glad you did, because I was just reading a book the other day, and I saw a little diagram, and it showed several houses in a little cluster with their fences around their backyard, and then a whole area that was bulldozed and cleared out for a community garden. And I'm thinking, now, isn't that interesting? And that they took the time to do a community garden when they had a nice backyard that was, you know, more manageable on an individual basis. So now they got their individual plots and they cleared out this whole area.
Huh.
And we get back, you know, and then from there, if you elaborate on that and you look at the way we garden these days, people are relying on other people growing their food. And I'm sure you feel pretty empowered to know that you can grow your own food.
Right. Yeah. And I think that that is one thing that we, you know, give away when we stop growing our own food. We give away that sense of security that there is in being able to do that, because, you know, that's one of the most important things in our society, and yet we've become so disconnected from it that people are, you know, if trucks and transportation were unable to come into a city in 3 days, we'd run out of food. And that's a pretty intimidating prospect. And to know that you can still feed your family because you've, you know, either have a garden and you've put up some food, you've either canned or frozen or dehydrated stuff. To know that, I think, is something that's very important to, or it's becoming more and more important to a lot of people. But these large-scale industrial agriculture types of monocultures where we rely on this system to provide us food, it's becoming more and more apparent that that's not a sustainable way to move forward.
Corinne, at this time, I want to just take a little time out and see if we have any listeners out there that would like to call in with a question or two. I want to give out some numbers here. We've got several lines. A call-in line would be 530-327-7602 and 530-413-4522. Or you can try in line 3, 530-413-5011. I would like to maybe talk a little bit about edges. That's a term in permaculture design.
Mm-hmm.
Edging. Edges. Edges of what? Edges of a garden plot or edges of a property? Or what are we talking about here?
Right. So in permaculture, one principle is optimizing edge. So it comes from the understanding in ecology that the intersection of two environments, say a forest and a grassland, at that intersection, diversity and productivity is highest. So if we understand that in nature, then perhaps we want to mimic that system. And if you think about it in your garden, say you have a garden and you've surrounded it by rocks. You know, oftentimes, where do things grow? Things usually grow between the cracks in the rocks along the edges. And you're constantly having to weed that area because that's where the moisture collects. And that's where, you know, seeds fall. So in permaculture, it's saying, okay, rather than that being a problem, let's make that into a solution and let's optimize our edge. So looking at your edges on your property, looking at your house and soil edge, or your sidewalk and grass edge, looking at spaces where you could be more productive. Often along edges, there are microclimates. So especially with your house and your soil, there's an edge there where there's a big microclimate, especially if it's south-facing, it's a lot warmer. But then it's opportunities to create more edge as well, looking at areas where you could, instead of having a round pond, you could crenellate the edges of that pond. You'd have the same area, but you'd have more edge along which frogs and fish and other things can create a habitat. It's also understanding that in nature there are no straight lines. So curving beds rather than having straight beds gives you more edge, or planting in such a way that you have different layers. So you have vertical layers too, where you have shrubs and then trees and then an herb layer, rather than all one, you know, monoculture of the same type of species of tree or the same shrubs all along in one line, trying to curve those edges and create more places and microhabitats for birds, for example, insects, and so you're creating these opportunities for mini ecosystems in a way on your property by just altering things. You're not changing necessarily how much area you're planting up, but you're changing the shape of that area. So really looking at ways to optimize that edge. It could be in certain situations that you don't want to increase your edge. You want to decrease your edge as well. So it just depends.
Well,
but
I was going to say, I don't mean to interrupt you, but you brought up a good point. I mean, personally, in my garden, we do a lot of rock. We have rocks that we collect from the property, make a little bed, and it curves and everything. Well, gosh darn it. At the edge of those rocks, every year we're pulling what we call, it's a grass. I can't think of it now. But, I mean,
Black,
it's just...
crabgrass or crabgrass? Right.
Yeah,
right.
The crabgrass. We call it something else. I probably shouldn't say the four-letter word over the air, but anyway.
Maryland,
what's the recommendation there? Is that, I mean, it takes over. It'll creep under the rock. Now, the rock is nice. You got water, you know, it's always moist and stuff under there, but we're forever pulling those rocks back and having to take that grass out of there because it takes over. What would you recommend for something like that?
That's a good question. I mean,
Maryland on line five. Maryland on line five.
I think I would most likely. I mean, those are situations where, you know, sheet mulching is a good option potentially to smother some of that grass to create more of an. You create like a second edge, for example. So you have the rocks.
Hold that thought. I'd like to get into a sheet mulch. We do have a question.
Okay.
Are you there?
I am here. My name is Marilyn.
Hi, Marilyn.
I have a son who lives in Colorado, and he has a unique yard situation where the water is coming from a water plant draining through his yard. And this year he's put in a garden, and he pretty much already has a rain garden, but it's in the lawn where there's not a lot of sun, and up higher, you know, the water's kind of just filtering down and makes his lawn at the flat part like a puddle. Tremendous amount of seepage. Until
right.
September 1st. And I'm wondering how he can do a rain garden or what kinds of things he could grow in this extremely wet situation.
And you said, though, that it's in the shade quite a bit?
Where the water really puddles is very partly sunny. And then just up above that, is where they want their garden because it gets the most amount of sun.
Okay.
They already have fruit trees that have deep enough roots that are getting this water.
Oh, great. That's great. And yet there's still this kind of puddle that just is on that
right
property.
And they have on one side of the yard a drainage that goes out to the front yard down the curb, and you know, it's just going down and out.
How about a pond?
It's a tremendous amount of water.
How would a pond in that area work?
I think he would worry about mosquitoes. You know, he'd have to have a motor and everything. Unfortunately, he has two dogs in the backyard there.
Okay. Because that's oftentimes, you know, if there is an area that's particularly soggy and you wanted a water feature, well, might as well put the pond where the water is already. That would be one.
I said he should probably grow rice.
Ah! Yeah, if it's possible where he's at, that's not a bad idea. Yeah. Making
you have any other possibilities? He's already put some drain tiles to try to manage the water to where he wants it to go.
I would say, too, that if he could do some type of rain garden to dig it down a little bit to make it more of a depression, and then putting in some mulch, that will at least... not make it such a puddle, right? It'll make that water infiltrate better. And then putting in some shade-tolerant shrubs or perennials in that area and make it something that looks nice. I don't know, you know, I'd have to see his property to really know what would work, but something that looks nice, that's kind of harmonious with the existing landscape in that area. That would be maybe my recommendation, but I'd probably have to see it a little bit more to understand. But I definitely think that trying to capture that water on the site, because it already pools there anyway, I think would be good through an infiltration.
Right, I like that idea. Maybe make a pond situation that he could take bucketfuls out to water the garden.
He could, yeah.
Or something.
Yeah, and I think if you put a pond in there that was actually, you know, a habitat, again with the mosquitoes, if you can introduce or put in, you know, aquatic plants and such, if you can introduce that into the area to attract things that would cut down on the mosquitoes, adding fish, for example. Then you might create a system that would be that would actually make the backyard, you know, have it be a really nice water feature. I don't know, Jim, if you have any ideas.
Well, it's just backtracking a little bit. I like the idea of, especially if you don't want to be dealing with mosquitoes in a water pond and whatnot with the dogs. I like your idea of digging a little deeper, putting mulch down, and growing perennials. I wanted to touch on that subject because perennials tend to give us more of a maintenance-free garden, and it teaches us to grow some of the indigenous species in the area and learn to eat them.
Right.
That's true. You can eat nasturtium and pansies and whatever.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the perennial planting makes, again, less work for the gardener as well, so that when, you know, in the springtime, you're not busy trying to start seeds and get all that stuff together, you know, the work is being done for you outside already. Nature is doing the work for you because you already have those perennials planted. So
established, right.
Yeah, and that gives you, I know that in Montana, that gives us a little bit longer of a growing season. It's like a jump start to the growing season. And so things that are perennial are coming up long before you can even think about seeding any types of annuals in your garden. So I think that would be good to make it a nice perennial rain garden bed. And then he doesn't have to maintain it as much either, and he can just take advantage of the water that just naturally collects there.
Great.
Folks, thanks for the question there, Marilyn, and the call in. We're getting to the end of the show, and I did want to touch on one more topic before we... I want to finish on your trip to China. You know, I think that the main topic, one of the topics here we just touched on a little bit in permaculture is eventually to have a maintenance-free...
What you want to work towards is more of a perennial system where you put in, you know, fruit trees and nut trees and berries, things like that that create what in permaculture is called a food forest. You put in a lot of your perennial veggies too, you know, garlic chives, you know, and herbs, of course. There are all sorts of herbs even in Montana that are perennial. And trying to find as many of those species as possible and have them be part of your garden and landscape space so that they just need a little bit of pruning here and there. They don't need the time and energy of starting seeds indoors and then having to plant them out and maintaining them fairly meticulously throughout the gardening season. If you have what's called a food forest, you're just doing a little bit of pruning and picking, and then you get to reap the rewards without as much work. And that, of course, is in a very well-established permaculture system. Of course, to get that established is going to take some time. But once it's established, the idea is that it is very little work for the yield that you get in return.
All right. Well, listen, Corrine, we're going to have to wrap this up here. I don't think you're going to have much time here to talk about your trip to China, but
okay.
I know you could go to a website, Good to China, to get an idea of these sky farms.
Mm-hmm.
Let's just wrap it up real briefly, if you can maybe in a minute recap that trip, and then I can close out the show.
Sure. I was in Shanghai, China, actually, which was a lot different, talking about scale, a city of 23 million people, and working for an organization that installs rooftop gardens. And that, again, that idea of bringing local, fresh, organic food to urban residents, which I think is so important. And because the urban population is just continuing to grow, we need to find solutions to how to feed that urban population while decreasing our carbon footprint. So as you said, you can go to goodtochina.com to check out that initiative, and then you can go to my website, brokengroundpermaculture.com, to check out what programs and workshops I'm running in Bozeman.
And you want to give your phone number, Corrine, for people to contact
Absolutely.
You through the phone?
Yeah, my phone number is 406-600-7881, and I do have an edible backyards workshop that's coming up March 28th, and an intro to permaculture design class that's coming up May 5th. So if people are interested, they can just call me or check out my website.
And that would be a fun trip for people not in the Bozeman area to take a trip to beautiful Bozeman, Montana, and enjoy springtime in Bozeman with Corrine Irby. That's
yes.
it, folks. That's our
Great.
Show for the week. Join us in 2 weeks, March 10th, when the show will focus on permaculture. And we're hoping to get to talk about dirt and growing your own dirt and compost. So we're going to focus on making soil. Future shows starting in April, we're going to interview some local sustainable business, some co-housing, and more. Next Saturday is going to be a show called The Urban Farmer, same time. It'll be a weekly show, and it's going to cover other aspects of our conscious awareness, care for people, care for earth, and share surplus. Go to bbsradio.com/permacultureprojects. I'm sorry, bbsradio.com/permacultureproject/ for weekly updates, topics, and guest list. Corrine, I want to thank you very much. It was a wonderful show.
Thank you so much, Jim. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you again. I'll be in touch with you. Adios.
Thanks. Happy growing season. Bye.
All right.